feel like I'm gonna throw up.
I went to Wendy's before I came here, like a big old dummy, because I was hungry. And I have a problem with fast food.
Yeah.
I love it so much.
How is that a problem?
Does not love me back.
So it's an abusive relationship that
and
you have with
I
fast food.
I spend entirely too much money on it when I go. Not like the long term of it. That visit is always way more money than I want to spend. I think it's because I'm hungry and I'm like, oh, I want that. I want that too. And you know what? I'm just going to get it all.
You're a large child.
Well, yeah. So on this trip to Wendy's, I got the $5 biggie bag with no ketchup because ketchup's gross. I got 20 nuggets with barbecue sauce because I don't know any other sauce at Wendy's. And then I got another double stack with no ketchup. And then I topped it off with a single cheeseburger, which I don't know why I got the single cheeseburger when I had two double stacks. I think I just wanted a road burger. But the whole meal was for the road, so I don't understand. Sometimes I just don't get my train of thought. But it is what it is, you know?
And with that, everybody, my name's Luke Burton. My name's Luke Bad News Burton.
I'm Psycho Steve Fury.
And this is WrestleOlogy. Not only is Steve about to have a heart attack, this is where we try to give context to wrestling present by looking at wrestling's past. And oh, I'm so glad. I'm so glad that I hit record. I'm so glad that I hit record so that I have that for the rest of my life.
That's fine.
Well, everybody, the reason why we are recording this intro is because our last podcast, episode 2, is actually going to be a two-parter. It was just after we had re-recorded it for a second time, we realized that we had actually gone longer than the first time that we had recorded it by like 30 minutes because we had actually done more research this time and we had already done a previous podcast where we were like fumbling over ourselves and we didn't know like how to transition and who knew what. And it was also the first time, I think, that we did it in the first night that we did the first podcast too, right?
Yeah. We recorded that episode with the intro to WrestleOlogy.
That is so much.
Which was a long night.
That's a long night. I mean, I feel like we do that all the time, though. Like, whenever we sit down and talk about this or we talk about the podcast or we'll, like, even when we watch wrestling, I feel like we go to the point where, like, we're exhausted because we want to do it, you know? We want to, like, watch wrestling or, like, do something with wrestling. And so we just try to, like, spend all of our energy doing it. And then by the time that we're done, it's like, okay, I'm done. I'm exhausted from this.
Yeah, I've watched so much wrestling where I want to say I'm burnt out, but I'm not. I think the normal person will be burnt out from the amount of wrestling I've been watching.
I get there too, because it's like, it's not the wrestling that burns me out. It's the information about wrestling that burns me out. I've been watching a lot of shoot interviews of like CM Punk where he'll go to like a Comic Con or something like that.
Man, somebody just sent me a TikTok, which I just found out that we had TikTok still. I thought that was banned.
Yeah, dog. That's a big thing.
News to me. News to me.
You thought that it was banned when like back about like a year ago?
Is that how long ago it was?
I'm pretty sure, dog.
Yeah, I thought it was banned. I didn't even know that it was still a thing.
God, you live in a bubble.
I like my bubble.
Hey.
But sent me a TikTok, and it was something along the lines of your favorite wrestlers and what people think of you. And he pulled out CM Punk, and he goes, you're a fucking hipster, pretentious prick. And I was like, whoa! I feel attacked.
Yeah. Not wrong.
Oh, man.
I love CM Punk, but I also feel like I also feel because I like CM Punk is the reason why a lot of people could deem it pretentious, because it's like I. So here's the reason why I like CM Punk. It's because I knew about CM Punk before he was in WWE. And how pretentious does that make me sound?
Yeah, I get so bummed out that I missed that whole Ring of Honor CM Punk time.
Well, he had a really good rivalry with Raven. And I got to send you that match. I was talking to you about it. It's this dog collar match that he had in ROH. And before the match, you see a young CM Punk before he goes to WWE where he...
Wait, Raven went to Ring of Honor?
Yeah, he went to
Ring of Honor. This is like the end of his career. Like,
this is like, yeah,
this is where Raven went to die kind of thing.
Yeah, I think that this was more so he no longer could work in WWE. I think that he had bounced between TNA and ROH. I don't know what the exact date of it was, but he was wrestling Punk in a series of matches across the United States and across the United Kingdom. And he wrestled him in a dog collar match, like early 2000s. And it was really good crowd work. And it was like this old Southern style brawl where they wrestled throughout the arena. They're going and chasing him down with the camera like it's an old ECW show. They have a spotlight that barely fucking works. So, so you're just watching like two wrestlers wrestle in the dark.
Oh, man.
There was a spot where it was incredible where like Raven had beat the shit out of CM Punk and they go all the way to the back bleachers and Raven goes all the way up to the bleachers to do the pose where he puts his arms out.
I used to love that pose so much when I was a kid.
And he's like reveling in the moment, and then all of a sudden you just see him just start to tumble forward because CM Punk had pulled him down, and he goes tumbling forward down these bleachers that are probably soaking wet in beer, and the fact that it's also pitch black. Like, you know that he can't see the feet below him. So I'm like, oh, he's about to blow out his fucking ACL.
Every bone in my body hurts right now thinking about that tumble down those bleachers.
But that, like, that type of wrestling where it was like, the best way to put it was like, he was not the same character, obviously, but the same style character. He reminds me a lot, or MJF reminds me a lot of him in the way that he talks, because he's
old CM Punk.
The way that he talks, not the way that he wrestles, but the way that he talks and the way that he's like articulate and he believes himself.
Oh, he's like Eddie Kingston.
Yeah.
Who you believe that doesn't... I think Eddie Kingston doesn't think wrestling's a work.
Yeah. I mean, have you seen Eddie Kingston, though? Like, that dude is one of the hardest men in professional wrestling.
Yeah, I wouldn't mess with Eddie Kingston.
No, dude.
I mean, I probably wouldn't mess with any of those guys to begin with.
Yeah, that's not a... That's...
Besides Marco Stunt, but even though he could probably still whoop my ass.
That's true. I mean, but you are a pretty tough guy. I mean, independent wrestlers come up to you and touch your tattoos.
Yeah, which that was really weird. Really weird.
So a little bit more context before we cut this intro off and go back into the episode. And by the way, if you haven't listened to the first part of this episode, I would really suggest that you do, because we're recording this intro before we know what part we're dumping into the second part of it. So do apologize for that. But after this story is wrapped up, we're going to fade it into the episode itself. So we're at Tampa Bay Pro Wrestling's, one of their first wrestling shows back from COVID. And they're out in the parking lot of this comic book / action figure retro store in Largo, Florida, which is really close to Truth and Consequences, Florida. Yeah, it's real hot there, too. Real hot here. So it's outside, and we're in the front row of like a three-row show, essentially. I mean, that's the best way to put it.
Yeah, I was like, yeah. There's three rows on each side.
And then there was a bunch of standing room only, like towards the back of the parking lot where the street and the parking lot met because it really wasn't a parking lot. It was like
essentially you didn't have to pay to watch. You could have just stood in the road.
100%. And like I felt so bad for that neighborhood because everyone was, it was just a whole bunch of like rednecks and people that just wanted to watch professional wrestling.
And that fucking lady. That fucking lady. Oh my God.
Yeah, man. They were all watching professional wrestling in the back parking lot of this like strip mall in the middle of nowhere, Pinellas County, Florida. And there's this lady on the other side who at every wrestler, doesn't matter if they're good or if they're bad. And I'm pretty sure her son's like autistic and I feel bad because I don't want to like make fun of this lady, but it has absolutely nothing to do with her son. It has everything to do with,
yeah, I'll make fun of the lady all day.
She's a fucking terrible human.
Ugh.
And I don't know you. If you're listening to this podcast, I'm so sorry, but at the same time, shut your fucking mouth. You at every point
have been told to shut up by every wrestler.
No matter if they're good or bad, it goes past it. It goes past the point where, like, you are now taking away the joy from me. And I'm pretty calm. You know me by now.
Yeah.
Like, I'm pretty calm and pretty mild-mannered. When I'm like, dude, can this lady shut the fuck up?
It was the same lady that apparently we heard that she's been banned from NXT also.
From NXT. She's the only person that's been banned from NXT.
I wonder how true. I'm going to have to look and try to find out if that's really true.
All right. Cool.
Okay.
Tight.
So
we are at this pro wrestling event, and this dude comes out, and he's okay looking, I guess. Like, he's like kind of in shape. He's like one of the most in shape of the professional wrestlers there. I'm not putting down Tampa Bay Pro Wrestling. It is affiliated with Jay Lethal's school, and Jay Lethal is Mr. ROH, essentially. This is like a very independent professional wrestler, independent professional wrestling promotion where it's like affiliated with a school of beginners. We are sitting at the, we're sitting in the front row, and this guy comes up to Steve and I, and he's dripping, soaking wet. He's about to wrestle his match, and he looks at Steve, and he's supposed to be the babyface, which is the good guy. And he looks at Steve, and he's like, "Hey, man, I like your tattoos." And Steve's like, "Yeah, man, thanks," because Steve's socially awkward. And this dude who is, again, dripping without a shirt, soaking wet, has a towel around his shoulder like he just had shower sex, goes and says, "Yeah, man, I really like your tattoos." And then with his left index finger goes and proceeds to go down Steve's fucking left arm or right arm. I forget what it was. Your right arm.
It was one of my arms. It made me, I don't even know how I felt about it.
It touched and like went down like his whole arm. And we just look at each other and I was like, what the fuck just happened with that? Like I was so uncomfortable. Cause I was like, I get like if you're trying to like intimidate somebody, but I feel like you were trying to make Steve like you. And it did the exact opposite of what it was supposed to do.
I feel like I get it. I get it a lot about like, "Oh, I like your tattoos." But it was the touching thing.
It was very sensual.
I mean, I'm a sensual guy, so I get it. I get it. But don't touch me.
Not like that.
I don't like that at all.
And with that being said, two rules with this podcast. If we make a 2-hour episode, we're gonna chop it up so that you guys get two episodes out of one. And then the second one is don't touch Steven the Psycho Fury.
Psycho Steve Fury.
Yeah.
It's cool. It's fine.
All right. Thanks. And everybody enjoy the podcast.
And when I got to watch that, I was so excited. I'm pretty sure I was like watching it, like making sure my mom wasn't coming. Like we were watching the old squiggly line porn.
or like the Girls Gone Wild commercials. You remember that?
Player. Hell yeah.
Yeah, dude. Joe Rogan used to host that. You remember that?
The Girls Gone Wild? I didn't know that.
Yeah, he used to be the guy that was like the
host of it. I probably actually did, and I just didn't even pay attention.
Well, I mean, it was him with hair, and he also wasn't taking as much steroids or testosterone.
Man, you don't know that he's doing all that.
He is very vocal about that on his podcast. Oh. Yeah. Well, I mean, I know that you don't know that because you don't listen to his podcast.
I do occasionally. It's not one that I listen to religiously.
Big fan of the JRE.
I've been listening to, and I don't know why, because he makes me so angry, his old Jim Cornette Experience.
I don't understand why you listen to him.
I don't either.
I don't get it.
I don't either.
I really don't get it. Because
he makes me really angry.
Yeah, that's the reason why I stopped listening to him.
He says are hilarious. Legit
funny. Yeah, of course. But I cannot stand that much negativity. But
he just told a story about a car accident in front of his house that I'm not even kidding you. I was laughing for 30 minutes.
So, because of this, and because wrestling started to lose its popularity towards the end of the 50s, a lot of promoters started using localized television as a weapon for them to eliminate the competition by purchasing airtime from rival promotions, effectively putting them out of business. Now, with this being said, along with a lot of promotions starting to lose notoriety, the fact that wrestling is starting to become more centralized and the fact that larger promotions are starting to gain notoriety, local promoters are starting to go out of business, challenges started and continued with the NWA entering the 60s. After defeating Carpenter in Omaha, Vern Gagne tried for 2 years to work things out with the NWA, finally settling on breaking away from the NWA. Vern Gagne opened up his Minneapolis territory, as it is known. And
Minneapolis,
real
quick, they produced a lot of great wrestlers.
Well, and we're going to go into that because he gave a storyline only edict to the NWA in May of 1960, that unless Pat O'Connor, who was the NWA World's Heavyweight Champion at the time, defended his title against Gagne in 90 days, then Gagne would recognize himself as the American Wrestling Association or Alliance? I don't know. The AWA World's Heavyweight Champion by default. Gagne's new American Wrestling Association unilaterally recognized O'Connor as the first AWA world champion, which is kind of funny because.
So now you have the NWA and the AWA, but the AWA was what? Minneapolis?
It was the Minneapolis territory.
Okay.
It was the Midwest. Yeah.
That's very,
I know,
confusing.
It's very confusing. And especially when you bring in, you know, the WWE and all these different associations. You know, there's just a lot of acronyms to remember. So there was never, with that, Gagne basically knew that the NWA would not call his bluff. They would not send O'Connor out to wrestle him, and that this basically was taking place as him to crown himself as the new AWA champion.
He's like, I'm going to challenge somebody that I know is not going to show up, so I can be the champion.
No, I know. It's crazy. I like
that move.
So, same month in 1960, Sam Muchnick, who had been acting as the president of the NWA, steps away because it's just been 10 years. He wants to find a successor. He's also old at this point. So, in the following 3 years, there are three NWA presidents. And over those 3 years, they are all promoters from different territories within the NWA. Frank Tunney from the Toronto territory with Maple Leaf Professional Wrestling. Fred Kohler with Fred Kohler Enterprises and a promotion out of the Chicago territory. And then Doc Sarpolis, I'm so sorry for whatever Greek family I just offended. From the Western States promotion in Amarillo, Texas. During these three administrations, Muchnick still acted, though, as the executive secretary. So he's basically there as their right-hand man while all these guys are running through.
Muchnick is literally just spreading himself so thin.
Well, here's the thing, though, man, is that he eventually comes back, and we're going to get to that after we go through what happened on January 24th in 1963. Oh my God,
what happened? Did something good happen?
Well,
is it juicy?
At the Maple Leaf Gardens in Toronto.
There's drama in this.
There is.
Oh my God.
Guess who? Guess who comes back? Back again.
Does Luthez come back from
Luthez is back.
Or Japan or wherever he was at? Tell a friend.
I don't know, but I know that because I didn't put that in my notes, and that's as much as I know. But he beats Buddy Rogers in a one-fall match and was declared the NWA World's Heavyweight Champion for a third and a final time officially.
You know what's funny? Buddy Rogers. Yep. I feel like that's a really fun name to have.
It is a very fun name to have.
Like, can you imagine, like, oh, this is my buddy, Buddy. His last name is Rogers.
Buddy Rogers.
Man, it just sounds like he's a fun guy.
It sounds like he's a fun, loving, good old American boy.
Luthez sounds like the name of somebody's going to kill you.
Yeah.
But I think it's just because I associate Luthez with a big bald man.
But he's not. He's hairy.
I know. We've already established that he's not bald. He is very healthy with a healthy head of hair and healthy chest hair. I get it.
Wow.
He has hair.
Why don't you marry him?
Maybe. Maybe my wife will marry both of us.
Okay. Cheyenne.
That got real weird.
That got real weird, and that was a lot of direct eye contact.
Oh, it was.
That was a lot of direct eye contact. So with Luthez defeating Buddy Rogers, he became the NWA World's Heavyweight Champion for a third and final time. However, after the event, Vincent J. McMahon, who was the father...
Vincent Kennedy McMahon.
Who was the father of now owner, president, and CEO of World Wrestling Entertainment, Vincent J. McMahon, who was the father of that man, Vincent K. McMahon.
Yeah, K.
And Toots Mont, who was also
Toots
a part
Mont.
Of the Gold Dust Trio.
Yeah.
Formed the Capital Wrestling Corporation.
So that means Toots Mont, at this point, has been in the wrestling business
for over
30 years?
I'm sure that it's more than that, player. I think that it's like 40 to 50.
Well, I mean, he was...
Because that's what? Early 30s?
I wrote down... I don't know why I randomly wrote just his. He started wrestling in 1912.
Oh, so he's been in the wrestling business for now 50 years. Because this is in 1963.
Yeah, that's good for him, man.
Dude.
Good for him.
If you got it, you got to flaunt it. Yeah. So... They're in the Northeast, and the reason why they refuse to recognize Lou Fez as their champion is because Fez was not a good draw in their territory. But Buddy Rogers was. So, with that, and with not recognizing Lou Fez as the World Heavyweight Champion, the CWC, which then would become the WWF, which is now the WWE...
And the CWC is the, what's that stand for?
Capital Wrestling Corporation.
Which is what they have named as the NXT arena now.
Which is the Capital Wrestling Center.
Yes.
Yep, the CWC.
It makes sense.
And it has the same logo, which is crazy, man.
It makes sense. They're honoring that lineage.
Yes, sir. So they withdrew from the NWA because of this. And as a result, McMahon and Mont formed... the Worldwide Wrestling Federation, which is the WWWF.
Three W's, one F.
I know. with Rogers as their first champion in April of 1963. Although both Gagne and McMahon promoted their world champions, their promotions continued to represent the NWA Board of Directors and regularly exchanged talent with those promotions. So they kept those ties with the NWA, even though they weren't a part of it.
Before the WWE Network went to Peacock, I'm pretty sure you were able to watch all those old AWA.
You were, 100%.
The Triple WF. I don't know.
Smoky Mountain Wrestling. Yeah.
I don't know if it's there now. I haven't really explored it.
I don't know, man. I know that a lot of professional wrestling is not PG. Like, especially, like, early on professional wrestling.
Oh, you mean Attitude Era also?
Yeah, 100%. So, I mean, as a result of it, wrestling has evolved and has become more acceptable into pop culture and is more acceptable into society. But this is still, like, this is still when wrestling is still believed as real, but is also still kind of a part of this underground, like, not popular culture.
Outlaw promotions or something.
Like, it's just kind of like on the fringe of society, you know?
Yeah.
So with this and the fact that they're exchanging talent with the NWA during this time. So consequently, around this time in 1963, because these other three promoters that they had elected to be the president of the NWA had just shit the bed, they unanimously elected back as their president Sam Muchnick.
This dude's like, I don't want to do this anymore.
He's but
like being forced to.
He's like,
much.
I kind of have to because everybody sucks at this job. And he held the office from 1963 all the way up until 1975, thus contributing a total of 25 years as the industry's most influential promoter.
Still to this day.
Yeah, well, I mean, no. Vince McMahon. 100%.
Well, I mean, he 100%. Had to have had some kind of inspiration.
He had to have some type of inspiration. If it wasn't for him, it wouldn't have become popularized the way that it is, and it wouldn't have become so national and become more of this American thing, right? But he became, at that time, he was the Vince McMahon of that era. During his second reign, Muchnick maintained the NWA's promotion as wrestling's top power, while he also displayed an uncanny eye for talent. Now we're going into the 70s, where that uncanny eye for talent is going to come into play.
Yeah, we're going to start seeing a lot of...
a lot of title changes.
And a lot of Hall of Famers.
A lot of people that are now known more so as legends. These were people that were up-and-comers. You know, they started seeing people such as Harley Race, Dory Funk Jr., Terry Funk Jr., Ric Flair, and Dusty Rhodes, and many others in the process come through their doors because Muchnick saw the promise that they had in his tenure. Now, moreover, he expanded the NWA globally by inking agreements with territories in Mexico, the Far East, Europe, and the Caribbean. So basically expanding what Luthez had already done and realizing that now with less promotions here locally in the States, we now had to expand globally and go over into these different territories across the world in order to keep revenue streams going. Now, with this, because wrestling was kind of seeing a little bit of a decline, the WWF, which was Vincent J. McMahon's promotion, who was the CWC, rejoined the NWA in 71 after their biggest draw, Bruno Sammartino, left the promotion.
Old Bruno.
Who was the longest reigning heavyweight champion of all time in any promotion, by the way, of like over 10 years.
So he beat Fez?
Yes.
Oh, continue. Like, because I think if you add up Fez's, all of his reigns
it's
combined.
It's half of Bruno's combined
that's
reigns.
Fucking
it's unbelievable,
crazy.
Bro, that some dude was on top of the world for 10 years. So with this, they changed their name from the WWF to the WWF. This is where you start seeing the modernization of
World
WWF.
Wildlife Foundation?
Yeah, with the panda dog. Now, in 1972, Japan Pro Wrestling Alliance, also known as the JWA, with their two top draws, Giant Baba and Antonio Inoki, left to form their own promotions individually. All Japan Professional Wrestling,
which was
Baba's.
Yeah, Baba.
And then New Japan Professional Wrestling, NJPW, which was Inoki's promotion, respectively. As a result, the JWA soon folded, and both AJPW and NJPW formed, and they became members of the NWA during various parts of 73.
Oh, so they weren't like NWA all the time. There was only certain
when they would have people come over, because think about it. This is a territory, or this is like an organization that's based out of the United States.
Yeah.
How often are we going to have somebody that's from our organization to be the world heavyweight champion. That's going to go across the globe. And how are we going to make money here in Japan for our company here in Japan if we have somebody? It's not like today.
I would say it's kind of like today because, like, think you got John Moxley, who's the United States champion. He's from here.
You're 100% right. It is kind of like today. However, the issue that you have with back then is that travel was not as safe, and it also wasn't as cheap.
Yeah, I guess you're right.
Yeah.
It was either
you had to take a plane, fucking boat, bro, like for 70s, safe travel.
But
there were a lot of, like, Ric Flair got in a fucking plane crash.
It's because he's a limousine driving.
Jet flying.
Kiss stealing.
Wheel dealing.
I don't know.
Son of a gun.
I messed that up.
No, you didn't.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we got it correct.
Okay.
So by the end of his tenure, around 1975, right, Muchnick reportedly declared Atlanta, Georgia as the leading wrestling city in America. And this is because of its drawing capacity of near capacity crowds at every show that they have at the City Auditorium, which is called the Omni, every Friday night. And the Omni is this legendary wrestling arena that is even still talked about to this day.
Do you think it's still there?
I don't know. That'd be cool to go to. Are you going to look that up while I talk?
I would never do such a thing. All of my knowledge is in my head.
All right, cool. So once Muchnick's second term ended, they had a succession of three different presidents again going into the 80s run the NWA. Fritz Von Erich, of the famous Von Erich family, who was known as, you know, he had the claw, which used to squish people's heads.
Oh, the thing?
Yeah, the where claw.
They grab your face
and then squish
it. See, I always thought the claw, maybe it's because I don't know, but where you just take your palm and you just put it on their chest and squeeze.
Nope. It was on their head.
Man.
I know. It's not like a five-finger death punch like in Kill Bill, bro.
Well, I just want to squeeze, try to get the heart out, you know?
Like in Dumb and Dumber?
Well, sure. I was thinking more of Mortal Kombat.
Ah, gotcha.
You know, some Kano shit.
And then Eddie Graham after Fritz Von Erich, and then Bob Geigel was also the NWA president. They would fill the role as the NWA president, all three. So Fritz was first from 75 to 76, Eddie Graham from 76 to 78, and then Bob Geigel from 78 to 80 would fill that role for the remainder of the decade. However, it was Muchnick's declaration that would pay dividends for the NWA when they made it back to Atlanta to make it their home base. So during this time, so the AWA and the WWF, or sorry, it's now the WWF, they started seeing a massive decline in their draw during the 70s. But during this time, the NWA was super hot with their national televised syndicated program because they were the first ones to get a national syndicated program on TBS. Which was Ted Turner's station.
Oh, yeah, old Ted Turner.
Old Ted Turner. With Georgia Championship Wrestling, which would then eventually become WCW. World Championship Wrestling.
Old WCW.
Yeah.
Did Ted Turner own any of WCW? He owned WCW, didn't
yeah.
he?
Yeah.
That's what I thought. I don't know why I thought he didn't for some reason.
Well, and the reason why he, and it comes up later, like to around the 90s, where he bought it from, I believe, I can't remember. We're going to do an episode on WCW where we'll dive more into it, but I'm pretty sure that
super
he bought
stoked
it.
For that.
Yeah, I know that that's you all the way, man. But I know that he bought it from, I think it was Jim Herd or somebody was that he bought it from, because that was the time that Flair had gone over to WWE, but we're about to get into that. So,
real quick, the Omni.
Okay.
It just came in my head. Out of nowhere.
Out of nowhere?
Yeah. So it actually was closed May 11th of 1997, and I got some bad news. They demolished it July 26th of 1997.
That came from your head?
All in my head.
Wow.
I don't know. It's weird. It's like I'm some kind of robot. It's weird.
Like you're a savant.
Well, sure. I just think I'm a robot.
Yeah, like a computer or something.
Beep 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 beep. Yep. Knowledge.
So with that knowledge in hand, during the 1980s, so we're now transitioning out of the 70s going into the 80s. It's now this transitional period of from the 70s where the NWA was making stars. They were becoming global. They had a nationally syndicated wrestling promotion in GCW. And they had Gordon.
Georgia Championship Wrestling. I think GCW, and I think of what GCW is now.
Yeah, which is just a backyard promotion, right?
Well, there's like two of them. There's like Game Changer Championship or something.
And then Game Changer Championship Wrestling or some shit like that. Yeah. But they would get probably the most famous wrestling announcer outside of Jim Ross, which was Gordon Solie, who is considered the Walter Cronkite of professional wrestling. That's on your thumb.
Is it?
Yeah.
I couldn't find it.
Yeah, dog. Just in case you didn't know what was happening, Steve had picked his nose and then didn't know where the... Yeah, no, you fucking picked, bro. You're not on the microphone, so I can tell the story. You...
This is picking. This is wiping.
Well, you got like a full booger on your thumb and didn't know where it went, so you started, flailing a little bit.
Panicked.
That's why you got up, right? So that you could get it wiped off.
Yeah, I had to wash my hands. I had a booger on my thumb.
So
I'm not hungry, so I'm not going to eat it.
I mean, I wouldn't have blamed you. So going out of the 1970s, going into the 1980s, this would turn to be a major turning point for the NWA as well as the entire wrestling industry in itself. Videotape training and cable television paved the way for the eventual death of the territory model that the NWA had relied so heavily upon.
See you later.
And the reason why this happened is because fans could now see themselves. They could see the discrepancies in the plots, the inconsistencies between the different regions and their storylines. So similar to how the championships back in the early 90 or the early 20th century, how they led to the eventual death of professional wrestling during that time.
Mm-hmm.
The same happened with the fact that people could watch different stories being told, and maybe one guy's a bad guy in one promotion and the exact opposite's happening in another promotion.
You can't do that.
You can't do that. It's breaking the fourth wall. It's breaking kayfabe.
Man, you don't break kayfabes in the 80s.
Yep. And with that, you know, it was just becoming a lot more apparent to people that it wasn't this mystical illusion that we come to know it today. Also, the presence of stars like Ric Flair on television every week made their special appearances when they would go from territory to territory, which the NWA relied so heavily upon.
Yeah.
It made it less of a draw because
them all the time.
Yeah, why would you go to the territory and wait for Ric Flair to come if you could just watch it on your television? It became more accessible for the people. So after nearly 40 years of success, this territory system that the NWA had relied upon so heavily was now dying. It was finally about to die. And in 1983, Vincent K. McMahon, who was
the son of Vincent J. McMahon,
and who is now the president of the WWE, which was then the WWF, saw the dying territory system as an opportunity to expand the WWF from this northeastern United States territory into the first national promotion. McMahon started working with WWF programming to get syndication across the United States, and this actually started to anger other promoters because he was taking away their business. And this was also kind of against that code that a lot of wrestlers and a lot of promoters had at the time. And it was also against a promise that Vincent J. McMahon had told all the promoters that he would not do.
Dang.
He would not buy out the other promotions, and he would not run them out of town because it was against business.
I wonder how much he bought all these promotions for in the 80s.
Well, he ended up, what he would do is he would sign their top star, and then he would...
just wait for them to die.
Well, no, he would basically buy out their television deal and be like, hey, see your top star. Like, that's how Roddy Piper came. He came via, I think it was from San Francisco, because he wrestled a lot in the Cow Palace out in San Francisco in California.
Well, he's from Canada.
Yeah.
So, I don't know.
I don't know.
I don't know where I was going with that.
I mean, I know that he's from Canada, but I know that a lot of people are from Canada that defect down here. But with that, became the sale of the syndication for Georgia Championship Wrestling.
California, right? And Portland, by the way.
Oh, for Roddy Piper?
Yeah.
Cool, sorry. Cool, cool. You're good. So with this, with having to start competing with WWF, they start becoming this juggernaut. Around 1984.
Would you call them a monopoly?
No, I would not, because there is direct competition, and they are having direct competition with the NWA. Yep, they are having direct competition with the NWA. I think that in the 90s, you could have... I think that after the 2000s...
Wasn't there a lawsuit about a monopoly?
There was a lawsuit, but I think that after the 90s, when they won the Monday Night Wars, you could argue that they became a monopoly because they bought up all the competition.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you can't...
Smart business.
It is smart business, but at the end of the day, it's also like... It's not a real... Like, it's choreographed. It's not fake, but it's not... It's not a real sport. So can you really, like, especially if somebody's willing to sell to somebody else? I mean, at the end of the day. So in July of 1984, it was a day that a lot of wrestling fans from that era would not forget. It was considered to be called Black Saturday. And this is when Vince McMahon, who was the WWF president at the time, took over the Saturday night time slot on TBS, Turner Broadcasting Systems, and had gone, that had been the home for GCW, which was Georgia Championship Wrestling. Yeah, I was going to say,
GCW, weren't they on TBS, but you just
said it.
Yeah.
Yeah, 100%. And they started promoting under, and because of this, because they lost the time slot to the WWF, they just started promoting under a different name, basically doing a rebrand. And they went from being GCW to what?
WCW.
Exactly. A name that most wrestling fans now know today, and became synonymous with the 90s until their break with the NWA around 91, where they started recognizing themselves with their own world championship. Jack and Gerald Briscoe had major stakes in the organization.
In WCW?
In WCW.
Oh, I did. Actually, I always thought Jerry Briscoe was a WWF guy, like, through and through.
Well, he was, but he started out in Florida. He was an FCW champion, or a championship wrestling from Florida champion. And I believe that he became an NWA heavyweight champion, but I'm not sure about that one.
We'll have to do when we do the NWA, if we do the NWA.
Yep. So the reason why this happened was because the Briscoes sold their entire stock, which included the TV deal, to Vince McMahon.
Scumbag.
So that's the reason why you see Gerald Briscoe still on WWE TV having an evening gown match with Pat Patterson.
This isn't like the 90s. I'm pretty sure he's passed away.
Probably. I don't know. Pat Patterson has. I don't think that Gerald Briscoe has.
Yeah.
I know that Pat Patterson
has. Have you ever watched any of Pat Patterson's matches?
No.
Are they good? They're pretty good, man.
He was ahead of his time. I mean, he created the Royal Rumble.
He was the head of his time for sure in his matches.
Well, he created the Royal Rumble.
Really? Yeah, that was his idea?
That was his idea. Yeah, it was his idea.
One of my favorite pay-per-views.
It is the best match in all of professional wrestling.
Yeah.
Like, it is the best match by far and away. But getting back on topic. So with that, the WWF show started showing on TBS, and it became a disaster. Mm-hmm. The core audience of GCW, which was more synonymous with like actual technical wrestling and more of these storylines that were not so grandiose and big.
Yeah, Vince McMahon loved this larger-than-life people, so they're very cartoonish.
Yeah, and it was more of a soap opera approach to professional wrestling. The audience that was more in the South preferred more of an athletic style. So, with that being said, Bill Watts, who was the promoter of Mid-South Professional Wrestling, and Ole Anderson, Championship Wrestling of Georgia, were both able to even gain better TBS ratings over this programming at this time to battle against the WWF. So, despite the original promise that Vince McMahon had for putting on original programming, he would just put reruns that he would have over at Madison Square Garden.
Like tapings?
Just tapings. He just would be like, whatever. So
he's
that he
literally
could stay
just doing it just to take away GCW spot.
100%. So he can just starve out the competition.
Fucking dickhead.
Now, with this, he actually started producing also a clip show. So he was going against his original deal. That doesn't sound familiar, right?
Nope.
Not at all. He started producing a clip show which featured highlights of WWF programming instead of original programming, which was a part
of
the original deal.
So pretty much just a whole show of trailers.
from house shows. Not even like...
Oh,
yeah,
man.
From house shows. Not even like what would be considered Monday Night Raw or like this pay-per-view. It was just stuff that they were working out at different places such as like Boston Gardens, Madison Square Gardens, and other major arenas. But it was never like supposed to be televised wrestling. It was just supposed to be for the house at the time.
Yeah, so they don't, isn't it during the house shows they usually try to test out moves, or they're trying to work out spots?
100%. They're trying to figure out what's going to make a crowd hot for what stuff.
That's, what a dick.
Yeah, but because of this, and because he realized that he wasn't getting a return on his investment, I'm pretty sure that's the reason why he stopped trying to appease anybody. So in 1985, he eventually sold the time slot and the GCW name back to Jim Crockett Jr., who would then form Jim Crockett Promotions, which then would run GCW and WCW.
I was going to say, they pretty much had the South on lock.
Yep.
Jim Crockett did.
And that's the reason why Atlanta is still considered like
R.I.P.
a huge
Jim
hot
Crockett
wrestling promotion town today. Now, with all of this being said, wrestling promotions across the country, fearing of being forced into bankruptcy by the WWF, tried beginning to unify and conglomerate under more centralized leadership rather than to continue independently. Now, competing promotions aired better talent and attempted to regain their audiences. So they started to group together again. But during this time, various promoters, such as in the NWA and Vern Gagne's AWA, attempted to co-promote shows under Professional Wrestling USA brand to combat the national WWF threat. However, because of like the status of power and control with the booking and the dynamics of power within the organization for backstage politics, the brand eventually fell apart, leaving it all with the AWA to its own time slot.
Oh, the AWA is still around. They haven't gotten bought up yet.
No, they haven't gotten bought out yet in the 80s. To ESPN, they had their own time slot on ESPN before ESPN was even like this big worldwide thing that everybody knows today.
Was the ESPN really around in the 80s?
Yeah, I think it started around like the late 70s or early 80s.
I mean, I'm sure it's sports.
Yeah, I know.
Sports.
Now, with this, around this time, Jim Crockett Promotions, when he bought out GCW, became the center of the entire NWA.
So all these NWA guys just pretty much flocked to Jim Crockett and hid under him, like, hide me, save us.
Yeah, I mean, he saved the NWA, essentially. With the buying of GCW, he acquired successful time slots on TBS. he unified certain NWA territories and ended up going national with the entire promotion by itself.
So this is 1985, right?
Yeah, this is 1985.
So you know what else happened in 1985?
Tell me.
WrestleMania.
Got it.
WrestleMania is happening. How did these guys combat that?
Starcade. Go
against
it? I don't think that they combated that with that. I know that Starcade was around Thanksgiving, and I think that that was really a combat. They combated Survivor Series with Starcade.
Well, because I know WrestleMania was really trying to get the mainstream by having all these musical artists on.
Well, they had Mr. T as their main event.
And they had Cyndi Lauper. Wasn't 100%. She there?
I think that it was either at one or two.
I thought Lou Albano was there because she was friends with...
The captain.
Yeah, Captain Lou Albano.
Yeah. You know, I know that he was her manager. I think that it's her I think that was her uncle, was Captain Lou Albano.
Oh, I thought it was because she was in that music. He was in that music video.
Yeah, but it was because she was related to him.
Oh,
I know.
We and could be wrong. If we're wrong, go ahead and
you should
add
email
us.
Email us at
wrestleology podcast@gmail.com, or you could also tweet us at _. I literally just went blank. I couldn't remember what that logo was. @_wrestleology. We also have an Instagram, which is @ Wrestleology Podcast.
We're not done with podcasts.
I know. I just was getting it out because I'm going to do it again. Don't you worry. I just...
Fuck, Steve.
Listen, man. I can do what I want. We're just trying to... Two dudes, two mics.
Are you literally telling everyone the description that's on Facebook right now?
Yes. Good for me.
I
right?
can't fucking deal with you. I can't even, bro.
Ugh. I think you're so fetch.
Dude. So with this, God damn it, where the fuck was I? WrestleMania, that the NWA needed to go national itself. So because of this, Jim Crockett started buying out some of the NWA members in the other territories to make them more of a conglomerate. Now, with this control over these territories, Jim Crockett Promotions started having more control over the booking. So he would limit the championship matches to performers that were under contract with JCP, which is Jim Crockett Promotions.
So he only pretty much gave the belts to people that worked for him.
Yep.
All right. That way you don't have to worry about anybody screwing anybody over.
Yeah, and you don't have to worry about somebody trying to claim themselves as this world champion and delegitimizing your title.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what he did was, if you want a championship, you have to sign with me, pretty much.
Yep. And he continued to do this all the way into 1987.
Huh.
Yeah, I know.
87, huh?
Now, with this, you know, a lot of the promoters, such as one of the presidents, Fritz Von Erich, the old Von Erich family. As you're scratching your sack again.
This time I actually am scratching my nut.
So with that,
I gotta wash my hands.
Fritz Von Erich withdrew his Dallas-based promotion, World Class Championship Wrestling, WCCW, from the NWA in a bid to become a national promotion himself. Now, abroad, similar to what the Von Erichs were doing, and also not seeing the value in being a part of the NWA anymore, EMLL, which is a Mexican Lucha Libre promotion.
They're still around to this day, aren't they?
I think it's CMLL that you're thinking. I don't think it's EMML.
Huh. That'll be a Google for later.
I thought that you were a robot.
When I say Google, I mean my robot brain is going to Google it.
So along with EMLL, All Japan Professional Wrestling and New Japan Professional Wrestling all succeeded from the NWA. In the 1980s.
So they were like, we're done. We don't want to be a part of your thing anymore. We're breaking up with you.
Exactly. Now, at around this time, at around like 1988, around the late 80s, with no viable option for selling, the NWA and WCW, quite frankly, went back to Ted Turner. And he ended up buying it in 1988, which was this completely different direction that they were going in from JCP, which was Jim Crockett Promotions. And they ended up renaming Georgia Championship Wrestling World Championship Wrestling.
Old WCW
officially. And with this would still continue the lineage of the athlete-oriented style of the NWA.
I want to say that Ted Turner was just the money behind WCW. I don't 100%. Think he really had anything to do with the day-to-day.
No, I think that it put them in a national spotlight that they couldn't have, because he had he had multiple different syndicated television channels.
Yeah.
And with that, had the ability, and I think that he loves professional wrestling at the end of the day.
Well, I mean, he's a Southern boy, so yeah. He's a
Southern boy. I mean, his CNN was located out of Atlanta. It just made sense for him to buy WCW at that point.
Like, I consider if you're from the South, you automatically like wrestling. It's like shrimp and grits. You know what I'm saying? Chicken and waffles.
Yeah. Peanut butter and salt.
What? That's weird.
So, getting back on topic. So, in order for them to compete with the WWF, Jim Crockett Promotions had to sell to Ted Turner in the late 80s. Now, with this, with them forming WCW, they ended up creating their own championship in 1991.
Oh, WCW.
Yep, which would become the WCW World Championship, or the Big Gold Belt.
Is that what they called it?
Yeah. I mean, that's the Big Gold Belt.
I mean, it's huge.
Yeah.
And you know, 10 pounds of gold.
That's the most beautiful championship of all of professional wrestling.
Oh, it's so good.
100%. So with this, they had a match between Ric Flair and Sting. Ric Flair, who was recognized as the WCW World Heavyweight Champion. And Sting, who was recognized as the NWA World Heavyweight Champion, would clash. Ric Flair beating Sting.
So they were unifying the championship. They were doing away with the NWA championship.
Well, no. I think that that's what their eventual plan was. But they recognized Flair as both the NWA World Heavyweight Champion and the WCW World Heavyweight Champion.
Dang, I think that, Ric Flair two belts, huh?
Uh-huh. And then do you know what happened?
I don't.
Ric Flair, in a dispute with Jim Herd, because Jim Herd wanted to name Ric Flair Spartacus, have him shave his head and then put a earring on him and dress up in a Roman gladiator
Could
costume.
Could you imagine?
No, I couldn't.
That, no.
No, I could not, Steve. I could not. What it's a garbage.
Terrible idea.
Yeah, it's because he thought Ric Flair was old and he thought he was washed up. So you know what he did? Because he had, I'm pretty sure that I'm wrong with that. I think that they had a dispute over the championship, and I think it was because of all the booking decisions that they had. I think that they wanted him to drop the title. Jim Herd wanted him to do that. Ric Flair said, fuck no, I'm not doing that. Still had the title in possession.
My man.
Didn't have a contract with WCW. Ended up signing with WWE.
He took the championships.
Yeah, you remember when he was with Bobby Heenan?
Yeah.
When he was recognized as the real world's champion with big gold belt on WWF Championship?
I don't know why it's just now clicking, but they never even talked about it. They just showed up with the belt.
Showed up with the belt, and he was the real world's champion. Now, with that, Ric Flair was immediately stripped of the WCW world title, but continued to be recognized as the NWA World Champion, causing a separation of both the WCW and the NWA Championships. Now, with this, the NWA would lay dormant for basically a whole year until a new champion was crowned in New Japan Professional Wrestling. but we don't even know about that. That's not even relevant to our history.
Yeah.
Because eventually in 1994, in a bingo hall in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, there was a tournament that was ran to crown a new NWA World's Heavyweight Champion after WCW had withdrawn from the NWA.
Oh, I wonder what promotion this was.
This was Eastern Championship Wrestling, and this moment when Shane Douglas defeated Too Cold Scorpio to become the NWA champion. I keep saying championship after somebody wins the championship. So Shane Douglas would win the
championship.
He's the championship. We got to write that down. That might become a t-shirt later. He's the championship.
I'm writing it down right now.
Cool.
In my computer brain.
So Shane Douglas would go on to defeat Too Cold Scorpio to win the NWA World's Heavyweight Championship. And he would stand in the ring and recite Harley Race, Ricky Steamboat, Lou Thesz, Ric Flair. All of these great men held this championship. And they can all kiss my ass.
Oh, no, he didn't. Sorry.
Yeah, player. And he crowned himself the ECW champion of the world, which effectively, until most recently with TNA, which is Total Nonstop Action Wrestling, would kill off the NWA and its territory system. And
well, I mean, we'll do more about the NWA, but it didn't kill it because you had. Oh yeah, you just said that, didn't you, about Impact?
So it didn't kill it off because in the 90s, they would become a part of Smoky Mountain Wrestling, but the notoriety that the NWA was now. This global power in professional wrestling was completely gone. Yeah. Like there was no legitimacy because this promotion that was barely even a promotion, like no offense to ECW, but it was a promotion that was ran out of a bingo hall in Pennsylvania, in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, that had sold out crowds, but they weren't touring. And they had old washed out professional wrestlers and young up and coming independent professional wrestlers that were not on contract that they didn't have syndicated television for. I mean, it was a local promotion
We'll definitely talk more about that.
Of course. But because of that and because of that incident, it ushered in this new era of professional wrestling where the lines between reality and fiction started to become blurred. And that would eventually lead into the Attitude Era. And with that, at almost 2 hours long, we conclude this podcast.
The origins of professional wrestling in the United States.
And the territory system, which we know as the NWA.
Yes.
Man, that was longer than the first time that we recorded that.
Yeah, I agree.
That was longer, but I don't feel as poorly about that.
I don't feel panicky.
No, I feel like that was a decent episode.
Yeah, yeah.
And with that, thank you guys for listening. I know that this is going to be a little bit of a process with us figuring out our way with this, and we're going to get better and a little bit more concise.
He won't listen to my computer brain.
No, I won't. You're right.
So, guys, girls.
Children of all ages.
Go and follow us.
On Instagram. At
Wrestleology Podcast.
On Twitter.
@_Wrestleology.
On Facebook.
Wrestleology Podcast.
Or you can give us an email at
WrestleologyPodcast@gmail.com.
And if you really like this podcast, feel free to go on any of the major platforms, Spotify, Apple Music, Google Podcasts, whatever, and subscribe to our channel. We come out with podcasts bi-weekly every 2 weeks with new content. Next episode that we're going to be doing is going to be diving into the history of the WWF, the WWF, and the WWE all the way up until the Attitude Era.
Yeah, I want to say that we're going to start 1953.
Nope.
Before that.
Yep. We're going to go all the way back.
Oh, all right. And then 2001, would you say is the end of Attitude Era?
Yes, sir.
Oh, that's going to be fun.
Yeah, player. So with that being said, my name's Luke Bad News Burton.
I'm Psycho Steve Fury.
And thank you guys for listening. This has been another great episode of the Wrestleology Podcast. We'll see you guys in the future. Booyah!